Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Most of the work in preventing child sexual abuse has been in teaching children to protect themselves. Don't go with strangers, don't keep secrets from parents, from other adults, education on inappropriate touching and the like. But today there's an effort to focus prevention efforts with parents over children. Now, statistics vary because of the shadowy nature of this crime, but the estimate is that anywhere from 1 out of 4 to 7 girls and 1 out of 9 to 20 boys will be sexually molested by the time they are 18. And 75% to 90% of those molesters are known and trusted by the families of the victims. Well, there will be a symposium tonight and tomorrow at OU Tulsa, which will address this shifting of focus. It's titled Shifting Child Sexual Abuse Paradigms. It takes place this evening and tomorrow at OU Tulsa. My two guests will be two of the speakers. Child abuse prevention advocate Sharon Doty of Arpeggios is the founder of Empowering Adults and Protecting Children. And Dr. Robert Block is a professor emeritus in pediatrics at OU College of Medicine and past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Dr. Robert Block and Sharon Doty join me today on Studio Tulsa. Sharon Doty, Dr. Block, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting us.
This conference, as the title suggests, is about shifting the paradigm of how we prevent child sexual abuse, from really educating children on what touches are appropriate and the like, to parents' role in prevention. How important is that shift in prevention?
When we only focus on educating our children, which is very important, you know, but when we only focus on teaching children to say no, run away, and tell somebody, we've actually put the job and the responsibility of preventing an adult from harming a child in the hands of a five-year-old. It's critical that parents learn the behavioral characteristics of potential predators, intervene, and protect the environment so that children never become sucked into the grooming process at all.
And we'll talk a little bit about the grooming process in a moment, but Dr. Block, do you have anything to add on that?
No, I think Sharon said that well. We've had a tendency to try to find ways for children to protect themselves, and Sharon's absolutely right. We need to have more awareness on the part of adults so that they can assume the adult role in this whole issue and protect kids.
Now, when you look at the statistics, 90% of child sexual abuse comes from someone that everybody trusts.
Correct.
So that's a real hard paradigm shift in and of itself.
It is. I think that's very difficult for the general population to get, and partly because it is those stranger abductions that make the news.
Right.
They're the ones that are more dramatic.
And those are the outliers.
Absolutely. Yeah. About 10 to 11% of the abuse is committed by just really nasty people who grab kids off of streets. But 90% of the risk to our children is by people known and trusted by our children and by us.
So talk about that paradigm shift. What are some of the awareness signs that parents need to know?
Well, Sharon's the expert, but I think that I'd add on to her previous comment by saying that, first of all, there are a lot of child sexual abuse cases that we never find out about because we're not aware of certain segments of society that are isolated and don't interact much. But there are places where even their children go, like schools and churches and public places, so that if the adults who are in charge at school or who are leaders at a faith-based environment or are working in a mall can understand that they have a responsibility for being careful about the children that they see, where those children might be, who they might be left with. And Sharon and her colleagues are doing a great job, I think, of trying to increase that awareness so that the example I always use that I learned from Sharon is if you're a parent and you're picking your child up from school, you're a little late, all the kids are gone except maybe for your child and another one, and there's a couple of folks wandering around the halls, you're not sure who they are. It could be anybody, a school personnel, or it could be somebody from the local electric company or somebody trying to do some work. You just don't leave. Just wait for a little while until that other child's parent shows up. That's just an adult responsibility that a lot of people would not think about until we talk about it.
You know, if it's somebody the family knows and trusts, it all of a sudden turns it almost into a suspicion of everybody. I assume there are really good techniques for parents and adults to know what's going on and be aware of things around them.
There are, Rich, but I would say having a healthy suspicion of all the adults that interact with your child is a proper and appropriate thing for a parent. Not a paranoid kind of suspicion, but the same kind of suspicion that we have about other people on the highway with us. We notice, we pay attention, we raise our awareness about what's normal and appropriate driving a car, and when someone who's driving along beside us or coming at us is operating outside of those parameters, we take appropriate action to intervene. We've identified behavioral characteristics of potential predators, that when adults recognize and internalize those behaviors so that they observe the environment and see those behaviors, they recognize the outside of normalness of that behavior, and then they can do something to interrupt. Like Dr. Blopp just said, you can simply wait till the next person arrives. You can join a group. You can interrupt a conversation. There are things you can do that are non-aggressive, that are part of a process that simply eliminates the opportunity for grooming to occur.
Well, give us a sense of some of those techniques. What are some of those outside of the norm behaviors people should be aware of?
Okay, one of them is people who always want to be alone with children. So if there's someone who's alone with children from time to time, as we all are, that isn't a problem. But if this person is always secluding children in an environment where others can't observe them, like, let's all go down to this room, or I'll take this one, or someone who says in a group of people that are dividing up the children always takes the same child and takes them to a secluded environment. That's risky behavior. Or a soccer teacher, music teacher, that says, I will only teach children in this room with no windows, and by the way, I won't let parents come in. The answer to that is no. Most parents, because they trust the music teacher or they trust the soccer coach, will let their kids go. So that's just one simple one. People who give gifts to children without permission and tell them not to tell.
Oh, yeah. Not to tell. Anytime you hear that, right, that should be setting off alarm
bells.
It'll
just be our secret, you know.
Right. Uh-huh. Getting back to Dr. Block, you said earlier, you know, a lot of these incidents aren't ever reported. And this gets into another facet of what this conference is going to be talking about. But if you can, talk a little bit about that. I assume it has to do with just the strong social taboos that still exist in our society about this and about the secrecy that's usually involved with child sexual abuse.
You know, I think that because it's a topic that nobody is comfortable with, discussion about this topic is often avoided, and people don't know how to have the discussion. There's been a number of cases that I've seen where parents who trust a neighbor or a friend who often invites children over unaccompanied by any adults, and something bad has happened. You have to balance between, you can't walk around being suspicious of everybody. You can't create a situation where your child can't go to a birthday party, for example, or can't visit with a neighbor. But you have to, as a parent, be alert, and as other people who can help us as parents, be alert to the fact that there are situations that on the surface look okay but may not be. And perhaps all you have to do is a little bit more exploration about who these people are, have them over for coffee. If the neighbor has a swimming pool, you don't, and said it's all right for the kids to come over and swim with me, that may be fine. But before you say, oh, great, they'd love to come swimming with you, maybe it'd be a good idea to say, well, why don't you come over and have a cup of coffee and we'll talk about the rules at the pool, and can we come over unannounced and bring snacks or something for our children, and sort of create an environment where you haven't just given carte blanche to somebody to be alone with the children until you get to know them better, or even after you do. There's a couple of cases that I've been involved in where trusted people, not just neighbors, doctors, dentists, other professionals who are isolated with children, can take advantage of that situation. And it behooves us as adults, particularly parents, to know who our children are with and who's going to be with them, other than just a one-on-one situation.
Now, that isolation seems like we keep talking about that. At times, isolation is probably normal in a given situation. But if it's always asked for, is that the warning sign we should be worried about? Because, I mean, there'll be times when your child might be isolated with an adult by random choice.
Right. But there's also, by random choice, that's not a risk. When it's a random situation, uh-oh, nobody's here. I actually got a call at late one night from a pastor who was stuck in a parking lot, and mom who had come was on her way to get the last child had a car wreck. And he's calling me. He's in South Florida. He's calling me in Tulsa to find out what to do. And so we talked through what could he do. He could call his board chairman and some actions he could take right then. And then I said, now what are you going to do tomorrow? he said, I don't know. What am I going to do tomorrow? I said, you're going to sit down with your staff and you're going to work out a process and a procedure that prevents this from happening again. It's just something you didn't think about. Those situations do occur. But if you're someone who particularly in your work with children is typically going to be alone with them, then you actually want to do that in an environment where you can be observed. Put a glass door on your office. Make sure that anybody who walks by can see you. They don't have to see the child. They need to see you.
Right. And this gets to another aspect of this is the fear from law-abiding people who find themselves in situations being alone with a child and literally fearful for the idea of false accusations or the appearance of impropriety and something that's very innocent. I think you've sort of alluded to some of the things you can do to prevent that fear from entering your caring for a child that's in need at a given time.
Yes, and you know, you can always call someone, call that parent and say, I'm leaving my house now. I'm headed to your house. It should take us about 8 minutes to get there.
Right.
Johnny's going to be in the back seat of the car. Set it up so that you have created an environment that invites monitoring and observation. You see, it's the environment that invites seclusion and isolation that we're afraid of. So if you're, that is the risk, right? So if you're someone who's setting it up so that others have the opportunity to monitor your behavior and you're open about that, and the behavior that you're exhibiting is public, non-sexual, and appropriate, then the risk of you being falsely accused is really minimal.
Yeah. Now, getting back to that, where these incidents happen and are not reported, there's a growing body of evidence that says that these issues still manifest themselves in the lives of these individuals well into adulthood. And it's one of the guests for this symposium will be Dr. Vince Felitti, who is a co-principal investigator of what's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. What is this ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences? What do we mean by that?
Well, I'll give you my two-minute version because I give a two-hour talk about this. But what Vince and Rob Anda, his other investigator, discovered is for a variety of reasons. Vince thought of doing this study where he would ask adults in his Kaiser Permanente medical practice, where they had really pristine records on people's conditions, ask them to do a questionnaire about things that had happened to them, might have happened to them, that he called the childhood adversities, and they included different forms of abuse, physical, sexual, emotional abuse, any kind of maltreatment, drugs and alcohol, domestic violence is a
neglect.
Huge factor, neglect is a big factor, and ask them just to say yes or no, this happened to me when I was a child as best I can remember. And for every time they said yes, this happened to me, they got a point. And then he just added up the points, and that became the ACE score. And then what he did, because they had the medical records, he compared what the health conditions were for this largely middle class and middle to just beyond middle age adults with their scores, their recollections of what happened when they were children. And what he found is that the higher the ACE score, the more likely they were to have some things that wouldn't be so surprising, like a lot of smoking, a lot of alcohol, increased incidence of drugs. But also what was surprising then is they had an increased incidence of heart disease and lung disease, other physical conditions. And it wasn't Vince's purpose to explain that. And it really remained unexplained for a while until the last few years, as the study has now caught on and more people are aware of it and are screening for ACE factors. What we discovered from neuroscientists is the physiology happening in the body and what happens in reaction to stress, called toxic stress, when children are subjected to these kinds of environments. And it actually changes the way the brain functions. It changes the way the brain is shaped. It changes the way the brain interacts with other organs in the body, which explains some of these increased risk for what we thought were separate physical diseases. So now that we know that, we're paying a lot more attention to asking during visits with kids, with our parents usually, about, you know, what's I like to use the word ecology. What's the ecology like in your family? What are the parents like? Where do you live? What's the neighborhood like? Do you live in a comfortable home in Midtown, or do you live in a not too comfortable neighborhood in another part of Tulsa? And we know where those parts are. And what are the associated adversities? Because if we find that out and can intervene, then we can protect the kids. Also, in relation to the main topic, is children in those environments are much more likely to not have a full blanket of protection from their family, from their parents or grandparents. And that exposes them more to being sexually abused, to being neglected, to being put in situations like having to watch domestic quarrels, physical and yelling and things all the time, which really is not a very healthy thing for kids to have to do. Poverty is a big area too, Rich, and I want to stick that in because we in this state ignore the fact that our children, a huge percentage of our children, are living in impoverished situations. Mm-hmm. So it's not their fault, and often it's not the parents' fault, but it's a condition that we allow to happen. And it's a condition that is keeping our will over time, keep the state from gaining a rightful place in leading states. And we're going to be sort of, there's a farmer's phrase I won't use, but we're going to be in big trouble because these kids grow up and become our potential workforce. And if they're traumatized, they're not going to be able to succeed.
It's interesting. Dr. Felitti was actually looking at obesity causes when he started this.
Right.
I mean, and he found that there was a link to obesity, which, of course, our state is one of the fattest in the country, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So there's all sorts of adult health problems that come with this correlation between these higher ACE scores. Now, the test is pretty straightforward and easy. I mean, it's literally 10 questions.
It's 10 questions. It's on the internet. People can fill it out just to sort of see where they would be. There is some discussion evolving as more people are getting into awareness of this, and we are beginning, our people across the country are beginning to do some research now on the best way to do an ACE screen with the family in a healthcare setting, and someday maybe in a school setting, whatever the setting may be. You don't want to make people aware that, oh, I have this huge risk because of my score, and then not be able to do anything about that. Similarly, if we're checking for families to see what, like as a pediatrician, I'm dealing with a parent or parents of a baby, and I want to see what's the environment of that baby, I should probably not screen for that if I don't have resources. Fortunately, in Tulsa, through lots of agencies, including now the OUTU School of Community Medicine, we have access to knowledge about community resources. And if somebody's hungry, we can get them fed. If they have them, I like the term brain health rather than mental health problem, we can get them to proper treatments. If poverty is an issue, we can help. If violence is an issue, we can help. And if they're worried about a child who might be subject to sexual abuse or other forms of abuse, we can find help for them as well.
My guests today are Sharon Doty of Arpeggios, founder of Empowering Adults and Protecting Children. She's a child abuse prevention advocate. Dr. Robert Block, professor emeritus in pediatrics at the OU College of Medicine, past president of the American Academy of Pediatrics. They'll be participating in a symposium tonight and tomorrow at OU Tulsa titled Shifting Child Sexual Abuse Paradigms. And it will look specifically at this ACE study and how it can be used to sort of break some of these cycles. I'm wondering, is the ACE test something that can be used as a guide for parents to understand their own background and of the people they know, love, and trust to sort of set off alarm bells,
I don't know the answer to that question. I think Dr. Felitti would be one who would have to look at that question. Our purpose in focusing on that particular study in this symposium is that it's necessary to shift the paradigm from educating only our children to giving our adults tools to interrupt these behaviors. And we need to find every way we can to get the attention of adults so that they really realize how critical it is that we as adults educate ourselves about this. And so bringing someone like Dr. Felitti to town who can talk to them about the real health risks to them and their children for the future if they don't do what's necessary to prevent this from happening is our goal.
Yeah. The sexual abuse is a big part of the ACE exam, along with a lot of different other causal factors. But, of course, I don't know the science behind this, but it's always said that basically, like a lot of these issues, there's a cycle involved. If you were sexually abused as a child, you're perhaps more likely to do that as an adult. Does something like an ACE score and knowing this add to a sort of break in the link in the chain, if you will, of that cycle, knowing that you've had these experiences? Does that add to the ability to combat these health problems as an adult, or maybe to break some of the cycle of adverse experiences?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. And we're learning about, I mentioned toxic stress before. We're learning a lot more now about resiliency, which is the other side of the coin. And you can actually, just like you can have physiologic reactions to stress, if we can help individuals become more resilient, they can reverse some of those reactions through the same physiologic kinds of biologic and, by the way, genetic mechanisms that are at play. So if somebody has been sexually abused as a child, they're going to carry that around with them quite a bit. Therapy for that is difficult, but it's possible. And we can break any cycles that might be there if they're willing to seek help, if we find out about them. Like I said initially, there's a lot of this we don't find out about. And I think it's helpful even for parents who may have had some of these issues when they were children and are carrying that around in the back of their minds to get some help in addressing the issues we brought up already in our conversation about, do I let Susie go next door to the neighbors or do I let her do whatever? And I would urge parents to be very cautious and very alert to what's going on with social media and the internet, and you know, we all heard about that. That's real stuff. And parents, unfortunately, cave when their kids say, oh, mom, leave me alone. I'm growing up. You know, I'm in eighth grade. Right? I'm growing up. Leave me alone. And mom or dad succumbs to that.
Mm-hmm.
There is pediatric advice here. There is no reason for parents not to be on top of what's happening with their kids because it's so potentially dangerous. 99.9% of kids are going to be fine, but 0.1% of kids is a huge number of children across this country. And it leads to problems like the kids on the street, and then the kids on the street get involved in prostitution. Sex trafficking is a huge sexual abuse area.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of manifestations here.
Earlier, you mentioned grooming, and this is going to be a big part of this symposium, is understanding the grooming process where predators, in essence, I assume, are ingratiating themselves within the family to allow these private encounters. And you refer to it as grooming, sort of grooming the family for this abuse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's what they call it. They call it grooming. They groom the children. They groom the families. There's three aspects of it. There's the physical grooming, and that might start with a tap on the shoulder. But over time, as the psychological grooming continues and develops,
becomes
the physical
more
grooming, becomes more and more.
More invasive.
I had one predator say to me once when he was being interviewed, you know, he would have the little girl sit on his lap. He was run his hand down their back, and he could tell how far he'd gone and how far he could go the next time by when they jumped up and ran off. Then he knew he could push it just a little bit more the next time. So there's the physical grooming. At the same time, the psychological grooming is going on, where they're saying things like, I love you, you love me. And children are confused by someone they know and respect saying that and then doing these things. And then if need be, they actually will make threats. If you tell, no one will believe you. And if you tell, I will do harm. And at the same time, they're grooming the community and the family and cultivating relationships of trust with the people who have charge of the children. This is a grooming process that predators talk about and coach each other about on the internet to get themselves more effective.
Well, I assume you'll be giving techniques and having, this is for caregivers and parents, or is it mainly for professionals?
No, it's actually for each and every adult who cares about kids.
Yeah.
So I'm a grandparent. I think every grandparent on the planet ought to be learning about this. But parents, youth ministers, teachers, social workers, anyone who cares about the future of children should learn about these behavioral characteristics and learn how they can interrupt them in a way that simply stops the grooming process. That's all we have to do.
Yeah. Now, tonight there will be a film,
which
is pretty close to home, right?
It is.
Tell us a little bit about this film.
This film is a documentary made by one of the victims of this particular pediatrician in Bartlesville. The film is called In a Town This Size. We sponsored it when it was first shown in this part of the state at the Circle Cinema a few years ago. It is the story of the children that were, over a period of 20 or 25 years, victimized by a pediatrician, a prominent pediatrician in Bartlesville. We'll be showing that film because this man, in the conversations you have with his victims and the families, this man exhibits every single one of the 10 behavioral characteristics we know about predators, except no one knew at the time. And no one knew that's what they should watch for. No one knew that's what they should interrupt. No one knew that what he was doing that was necessary to accomplish what he was up to. So we want to show this movie because it happened at a time where those victims that are on this are in their 40s and 50s. it happened at a time when nobody was noticing or nobody would have noticed. And now we know. We interviewed 100 predators and we know these behaviors. They're
And also, it was also a time in life when you did not question your pediatrician, a teacher, a principal, a church leader.
Right.
And all of these things.
Church leader, right.
Right.
So the movie sort of lay the groundwork for, and at the end of the movie, there'll be a discussion. Dr. Block and I will be participating in that discussion, along with a remarkable woman in this community whose child was victimized by her husband. And he recently was released from prison. She's going to be there on the panel with us. And we're going to answer the questions so that people can begin to see what it is we're pointing to and how what we're bringing them the next day might be distinct from any other kind of conference they've attended.
Yeah, and the symposium on Friday will involve presentations from Dr. Block, yourself, Dr. Folletti, and some other folks talking about these techniques. Let me ask you, once parents have this understanding of predatory behavior and the warning signs, how great of a difference does it make in preventing child sexual abuse? I mean, that's kind of a hard thing to prove. You're proving a negative, but does it make a difference?
Well, actually, we do know that it does make a difference. And how we know that it does make a difference is that this new paradigm was actually developed through a grant from the National Catholic Risk Retention Group in the late 90s when they were looking for a way to impact society and make a real difference. And they chose this subject and said, we've got to find a way to educate adults. At the same time, the CDC was saying, we need to find a way to educate adults. But National Catholic invested the money, the time, the energy, and the expertise. And we developed a program that was then ready for the crisis that erupted. And so that program, called Protecting God's Children, which will also be presented at this symposium as a non-Catholic version called Protecting All Children, that program's in 120 dioceses, and 1.5 million adult Catholics have been through it across this country. And what we know from there is that things are changing in those congregations, in those communities. People have they've built new paradigms for how they work with everyone who interacts with kids, and they are reporting more, and they are intervening more, and they are establishing new guidelines that create safe environments.
Any closing thoughts before we close out?
Well, I think that it's a conversation that we can continue in the community, and we can help all the people you mentioned who might be coming to the symposium, as well as parents, and talking with parents about how to talk with their own children. There's a sense of awareness there, not holding the child responsible, although we do want to teach them to say no and run away, but we also want to open up the chance for communication between parents. So after a child's been at a place, they can ask them, how to go? How was it? Did you have fun? What happened? That kind of thing. So it'll be an ongoing process for us. And then our last hurdle really is to reach out to those families that I mentioned before that are sort of isolated from the rest of our society, don't have opportunities to listen to, well, they could listen to your show, but probably aren't. You know, get them engaged as well and recognize that they are important and so are their children. And as a community, we'll move forward.
And we need to keep in mind, we're talking about huge numbers of population. The ACE scores, about 20% of the segmented populations have gone through this, have at least three or more.
At least.
Actually, the numbers in Oklahoma are much higher.
So this is a cycle that's probably going to get worse before it gets better?
It is.
Well, important information. Dr. Block, Sharon Doty, thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Child abuse prevention advocate Sharon Doty of Arpeggios, the founder of Empowering Adults and Protecting Children, and Dr. Robert Block, professor emeritus in pediatrics at OU College of Medicine, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. They'll be two of the four guest speakers at Shifting Child Sexual Abuse Paradigms, a symposium taking place tonight with a film and tomorrow at OU Tulsa. More information at empoweringadults.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.